This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Most of us have a big picture understanding of the ways human choices are changing the planet. But how is the planet shaping the big and small choices we make every day? The new podcast, Terrestrial, traces the decisions people make based on the environment, like perhaps a couple's decision not to have children because of overpopulation, or the exploration of composting as an eco-friendly way of disposing of dead bodies. Longtime environment reporter Ashley Ahern is the host of the podcast. In the first season, she traveled to North Carolina to explore new ways of thinking about death. Terrestrial is produced out of NPR member station KUOW in Seattle, and that's where Ashley Ahern is right now and joins our program. Hello, Ashley.
Hey, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing great. Tell us more about the premise of this podcast.
Well, so I've been covering the environment for more than 10 years, and I got kind of burned out on telling people how we're breaking things and what the scientists are saying about where things are headed. And I wanted to start asking these kind of deeper questions about how we live with that information. What do we do with it? Because increasingly, I feel like we don't necessarily need more information about how the planet is changing. We need to think about what we're going to do and what things we can control, what levers we can pull. So the premise of the show is looking at the choices we make in this world that is changing, that we're changing.
Yeah, and you also, as you said, you're a longtime reporter. You've reported on environmental questions, and this problem occurred to you that when you're faced with what to do next after you've given this the gloom and doom picture, is there any difference? Right? I mean, that's what we do. We say, hang up, I go have lunch, and I say, I wonder what I've done. So there's people out there who have just messed up with their minds. Is there any difference in the approach that you took to storytelling, having that problem in mind?
Well, I think that I wanted to go personal, and I wanted to get into how we look at death. And it's something that I think in our society we don't really talk about enough. And so often it comes to the very end of life, and people are facing choices, but they're not in a great place mentally to be making those choices or to realize that they have more options than conventional burial or cremation or to ask for more choices. And so I came across this really interesting woman. Her name's Katrina Spade, and she's an architect here in Seattle. And she has designed a facility that can compost human bodies, and it's not built yet. So what they're doing is they're trying to test proof of concept, and they're working with Western Carolina University there, Dr. Cheryl Johnston, and the forensic anthropology program. And so they're trying to figure out, okay, if you were to compost a human body, how would that work? What kind of substrate, you know, what kind of soil do you want to use? How long would it take? You know, we have a lot of things like hip replacements, things that need to be thought about in terms of if you're trying to make compost. And so it's a hard question. It's a deeply personal question, and it can be kind of icky for some people, and kind of runs against maybe how they think about the end of their lives and what they want to see happen, maybe what's culturally or religiously appropriate for their family. But I just wanted to explore one new option that's out there and that people are trying to figure out, because, I mean, at the end of the day, Frank, like when you look at, you know, conventional burial takes up green space. And as more of us live in cities, that green space around cities is increasingly used for cemeteries. And in the future, we may not have as much of that space available. Maybe, you know, there'll be other needs or pressures on that green space. So just trying to think about new choices in the world that we're facing. It's exciting.
And this was just one episode. In fact, your first episode to take a look at the effect of death practices on the environment and then how we respond to that. And just to give us a sense, though, of what you found in your reporting, I mean, just the amount of formaldehyde alone that gets used in our process is quite a bit, right?
Yeah, according to one statistic, it's 8 Olympic-sized swimming pools per year are put underground in human bodies when we embalm them with formaldehyde and other toxic chemicals. And I'll never forget it. I was actually in North Carolina, and I was with some scientists, and we were driving by a graveyard, a cemetery, and I turned to one of the scientists, not Cheryl, and asked, you know, when you look out the car window, when you see the cemetery that we're driving by, what do you see? And I'm thinking like green, peaceful hillside. And she says, I see an unregulated toxic waste dump. Mm. And that just stuck with me. I hadn't ever thought about it that way. So it's just it's
not to mention the amount of wood that goes into the caskets and all these sort of things. So very interesting questions. And then, as you mentioned, there is this possibility of composting. Let's be a little more practical about this. And you talked to architect Katrina Spade,
yeah,
right there in Seattle. So give us a sense of this, because we're going to play a clip that describes a little bit of it. But give us the picture of the sort of the building, the edifice that you walk into, where this demonstration takes place.
Katrina's spent a lot of time thinking about this and trying to be sort of culturally respectful. So I think, you know, when people hear composting human bodies, they can go to a very, you know, weird place pretty quickly. But the way she's envisioned it is taking maybe an old building, or like in one instance, maybe an old church, and kind of changing the interior so that you can put this, you can build the sort of, it's called a core, that would have layers of pine chips interspersed with human bodies. But around that that core would be a walkway so that there can be a ceremonial component that you're carrying your loved one in a shroud up this walkway and then putting them at the top of this pile. But you don't, when you look at the pile, you don't see any other bodies because there's layers of pine chips and other material in between. So it sounds like a pretty, and then outside of the facility, there will be gardens and places for people to reflect. And so it's just, she's spent a lot of time thinking about how can you make something that incorporates the way we want to interact with our loved ones when we say goodbye, as opposed to just looking at it as sort of, yeah, composting, you know, food scraps in your garden.
And I think one of the great things about this episode is that it illustrates the point you just made. There are people who are thinking about this, whether or not we like to think about it or not. And,
right,
and however,
right,
however uncomfortable we get at the possibilities, there are people who are thinking about it, but then it also tells us that the rest of us aren't, and that when we do, mm-hmm, you know, we get a little bit appalled. And you did talk to people about their how they would deal with this, whether or not they could even conceive of treating their loved ones this way. So to give us a sense of how people feel about this when you present them with something they may not have thought about.
Well, I talked to a professor of world religions, actually, in L.A., and he was talking about how actually this idea is fairly in line with Muslim traditions that are pretty minimal in terms of how they treat bodies after someone dies. You know, it's washing and shrouding, and much less involved in terms of a giant cement underground encasement and a coffin, the way Western and I think Christian background burial practices are. So he was kind of saying, you know, in Hindu tradition and Muslim tradition, Buddhism, this probably wouldn't be that crazy of an idea, but that for some Christians, and my family probably included, I mean, one side of my family is Catholic, and I still remember my great aunt Gilda, when she was buried, she was, you know, embalmed, and she had an open casket, and she was very made up, and she looked like she was alive. And that memory stuck with me, that we spend so much time trying to fight this natural process. And so, yeah, not all people are going to respond, right, you know, are going to jump on this idea. But I will say that even in talking to my parents about this episode, I think that my mother still feels like, you know, cemeteries are really important places to go and spend time with those loved ones and have that connection. But for my father, he was like, well, yeah, you know, he started making jokes about that movie Soylent Green and kind of getting creeped out about it. But then he was like, you know, I think I'm open to this. When I go, if this thing's ready, like, count me in. I was like, right, all right, Dad.
Well, and it also, I think, points to the value of this kind of reporting, which is to say that, yeah, at first we're creeped out, but that's because we haven't thought about it. So giving us the opportunity to kind of think about it, even if we recoil in horror at the first blush,
right,
but then you do. You go back and you think about it over and over again, and some of these ideas become you know, more plausible to us over time, for some of us. So I think that's the importance of bringing this thing, this kind of thing, to the light of day. Well, you also are exploring what people are talking about in terms of particularly millennials and having families in the face of particularly global warming, climate change. What do we do? Is it responsible to have a child in this era? Tell us what you found.
Well, I want to be sure to clarify that this show is not about telling people what they should do. It's about exploring the ways people are approaching these questions that are universal, right? I mean, most people will face at some point in their life the decision about whether or not to have children. I'm facing it right now. I'm 33, married. My husband and I are thinking about this, but I spend a lot of time thinking about the science and what scientists are telling us about where things are headed. And so for me, it's less about making people feel guilty about, you know, if you have a kid, this is the impact on the planet. Like, we already kind of know that, so nobody needs to have that kind of hammered into them. What I wanted to do in this episode was say, okay, if you have a kid, if I have a kid today, what's it going to look like in 20 years, 40 years, 60 years, 80 years? Like, and so I turned to this scientist. He's a great guy, Chris Field at Stanford University's climate change studies, you know, catastrophe and climate modeling, and what the models tell us where things are headed. And just asked him, how's it look? And he had some pretty pretty dire predictions. But he also said, you know, there are some choices we can make right now about what we do that could stave off some of the worst of these projections. And it's not too late. And so I think that, you know, we use these kind of personal choices to look at these bigger picture systems and problems that we face. And so do I personally have an answer? I don't know what I'm going to do on the kid thing. My husband and I are thinking about it long and hard and have promised ourselves it's an ongoing conversation. And so this podcast is for anyone who's in that conversation or maybe has had a kid, two kids, is thinking about having more. Like wherever you are on the spectrum, you'll hear somebody in this episode who probably speaks to you. We interview one guy who started the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement, mm-hmm. which is probably surprising, but they are in Portland, Oregon, and think that, you know, people should stop having babies and we should voluntarily like exit the planet basically as a species. And so, you know, some of the ideas are wacky. Some of them are, you know, a little closer to home with a couple, a young religious couple who says, we get climate change. We know how this works, but we're going to have as many children as God gives us because that's what our religion tells us.
I don't know how crazy that is. I mean, to some extent, this is like the planet is on the verge of saying, you know, you're fired. To humanity.
Out, yeah.
And in a way, what
you're
this
done.
Guy is saying is you can't fire me, we quit. So I'm not sure that it's that crazy, but you do. And there are people who say, look, there are too many people and that's a big part of the problem. And people have not only generated some of the things that are causing ecological damage, but the fact of the sheer number of us is too many. So that's mm-hmm. one reason why some mm-hmm. would say I can't contribute to that problem. But you also talked to Keenan and Brianna Fitzpatrick, mm-hmm. who are very concerned about all of these things. And had a very different take on it.
Every child is a miracle and a blessing in itself. I just know for us, the environmental concerns are not going to lessen the amount of kids we have.
They told me they're happy the Pope has called on his followers to fight climate change, but that for Catholics, it's not right to blame children for the problems in the world. And Keenan and his wife say, who knows, maybe their children will be part of the solution.
What if baby Fitz, because we don't know the gender, what if baby Fitz will be the inventor of a completely green and sustainable factory? How can we bring our children into this world to better, in a more holistic and pure way, use its resources?
There it is, a clip from the new podcast Terrestrial. That's Keenan and Brianna Fitzpatrick, who are talking with Ashley Ahern, the host of the podcast, and also talking with me today. Yeah, very. It's not a dyad either. This is not a polarized question because there are other mm-hmm. reasons. I mean, one is let's not have children because we'll contribute to the population that is the problem. Another, don't bring a child into this mess. What a horrible thing to do to a child. And mm-hmm. at least a third way, which is, yeah, it's a mess and who else can solve it but the people who created it. Let's have more babies. Yeah. And so it's a very complicated and kind of a wonderful question to explore in the way that you have. What else did you find? What did you find? What are some of the other sort of nuances that came up in this question? Nuances that maybe you wouldn't have found kind of with the conventional sort of reporting that we've been doing on this question.
Well, I talked to an author, actually, who's written a couple books on overpopulation. His name is Alan Weissman. And he found something really interesting, that as women and girls are more educated, when they get even a secondary school education, they tend to have fewer children. And his big realization after talking to some of the best demographers and people who study population and census data in the world is that if we had one child, so even if it's not about having no children or having many children, if we even had, you know, one child, then we could bring the global population under 2 billion. And right now we're on target to be hitting 11 billion by the end of the century. And that is a number that scientists say is not going to work for the planet as a system. It just can't support and feed that many people. So in reporting this episode, I kind of surprised myself in finding that this wasn't a yes or no answer. It's much more, there are many more shades of gray. And so maybe, you know, my husband and I joke about, people probably know the concept of carbon offsets, where like if you're going to emit, then you try to pay other people to not emit. And so we're sort of like, well, if we don't have a kid, then maybe we're kind of like doing a kid offset. And so someone else can have, you know, a kid and then it'll all even out in the wash. So it's just, I don't know. It's not about you're right or you're wrong.
Right.
It's just about exploring the choice.
And you say, as you say, part of the premise of this podcast was this addressing what you might call eco-anxiety, right? The sense that we all know something's happening. We don't know what to do about it. Tell us more about that and what you found, because you have an episode that really tackles that head on, this question of eco-anxiety. What do you mean by it and what are you finding?
Yeah. So when I first heard this term several years ago, I kind of wrote it off because I was like, OK, that's for people who like sit on their yoga mats and worry about the world going to hell in a handbasket. Like, I don't have time for that. But when I actually started poking around on the scientific connection between our brains and the environment, there's some very real stuff going on that psychologists are becoming more and more aware of, that basically we are creatures. We are animals that live in our environment. And when we see that the environment is not doing well, we respond to that in a very primal way. And so in the episode, we get into the amygdala, this part of the the brain. It's a cluster of neurons about the size of an almond that triggers the fight or flight response. And it's triggered by both immediate emergency, like a fire in your house, but it's also triggered by anxiety. Like when you are scrolling through your Facebook feed and you're reading news headlines about, you know, for example, birds in the Pacific Ocean dying with bellies full of plastic trash, like that affects your brain in a very real way. But the problem with the environmental problems we face, like climate change or big, you know, plastic in the ocean, is that fight or flight doesn't work. It doesn't solve that problem. And so we're left with this constant sort of sense of, it's like chronic fear of the you know, environmental degradation that we are putting onto the planet right now. So that was we spend this episode kind of following the journey of this filmmaker who has traveled to a small island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and studied a bird called the Laysan albatross and gathered hours and hours of footage of these birds who are eating plastic trash accidentally out of the ocean, and their bellies are full of it, and they're dying. And so it's this... It's tragic what he saw, but what we do is we use his story and the personal psychological toll that it took on him and how he worked through it as a way to kind of get into a feeling that many of us probably have and maybe haven't even acknowledged it.
I am talking with Ashley Ahern, the host of the new podcast Terrestrial, on the state of things. As a matter of fact, we have a clip from that episode talking about Chris Jordan finding all of this trash in the gullets of seabirds, and let's hear this clip.
It was a white ring of the outside ring of a bottle cap right inside the rib cage of a dead bird. And I remember just this shock, and we filmed it and made a big thing of it.
But that was just the beginning.
And then there was another one right next to it and another one right next to it. And the amounts of plastic in many of these birds is just so astonishing. It's like a quart of plastic inside a bird whose stomach is supposed to be the size of a ping pong ball.
That's a clip from filmmaker Chris Jordan on the new podcast Terrestrial from NPR member station KUOW. And we're speaking with the host of the podcast, Ashley Ahern. So tell us more about Chris, because there's more to that story.
Yeah, so the first time he went to Midway, was the birds were away. They weren't nesting at that point in the year, so the island was empty except for the carcasses of many of the birds who had died because of this plastic pollution. And so he goes there and he enters this kind of horrible place of death, and he's documenting this. He's taking all these photographs, and then he goes home and he slips into a year of depression, and he smokes a lot of pot, frankly, to soothe his amygdala and, you know, that stress we were talking about, the anxiety. And he turns to his friend. An interesting kind of shift happens. He turns to his friend, Terry Tempest Williams, who's a famous writer, and he asks her, he's like, okay, I'm going to do a book of the pictures of these birds and try to raise awareness about the problem, but I need you to write a hopeful introduction. And Terry basically says, I can't get you to hope from here. This is a horror. This is a dark, dark place that you're in, and you have to go back, was her advice. And so the beauty, what we do in the episode is we follow, you know, Chris kind of takes us back to Midway and back to these birds when they're there, when they're alive, when they're mating, when they're raising their young, and they're beautiful birds. They have like a 7 to 8 foot wingspan, and they cluck and clack their bills and dance with one another. Couple, the birds mate for life, and as they grow older, their dancing and singing becomes more and more synchronized. And so when Chris goes back, he discovers his love for these birds and the joy of them when they're living. And I think that that is the key to him processing the grief and the anxiety that he was struggling with, is that I think so often, he says, in Western culture, we deny ourselves, we're afraid of grief, and we deny ourselves the depth of emotion that we are capable of, because it's scary to go there. It's scary to you know, scroll through your Facebook feed. I know I do this, where I'm like, I can't read that article. I don't want to read that. Like, I see the headline, but I'm not going there. And for Chris, it was about facing it full on, embracing the grief and moving through it to realize, I love this thing, I can mourn it, and then I can find clarity in my own head so that I can get to work and figure out what I need to do with my time on the planet.
Great
and
stuff.
So that's kind of what, yeah. So
yeah.
We're just hoping to kind of move through just the bad news story of the birds with the plastic and get to something greater.
And get to something greater by going into it instead of out of it. And I think that's great stuff, Ashley. Good to talk with you. Thank you so much, Frank. Yeah, Ashley Ahern's an environment reporter with NPR member station KUOW in Seattle and the host of the new podcast Terrestrial. And you can find links at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, music about war and peace from the North Carolina Master Chorale Chamber Choir. Stay tuned.